you enjoy Coffeehouse Shots from The Spectator, then why not check out Spectator TV? Every Thursday night, Andrew Neil and a collection of guests, as well as The Spectator's home team, bring you analysis on the latest developments in current affairs, coronavirus, and more. Brought to you in conjunction with the NatWest Group.
Hello and welcome to Coffeehouse Shots, The Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Katie Balls and I'm joined by Fraser Nelson and James Forsyth. So it's back to coronavirus and there is a new buzzword in town. It is circuit break. James, what is a circuit break?
The idea of a circuit break is that infection rates are rising across the country in all age groups. And what the government is being pushed to do by some of its scientific advisors is to do a circuit break, which would essentially be a kind of semi-lockdown. So shutting certain social spaces like hospitality and things like that to try and stop the spread of the virus. So the idea is you can carry on going to work and going to school, but social stuff will be stopped to try and stop the spread of the virus. There is talk of coinciding this with the October half term. And I think that what we're going to see is the reaction to this, which is it heightens this debate about what is your choice between the economy and public health? Because obviously the economic effects of this for the hospitality sector would be pretty devastating. But it's quite clear that Boris Johnson has been pushed by various of his advisers to do this as the only way to stop the caseload from just carrying on rising.
Now, let's just do a quick focus group, taking on the style of number 10. Fraser, circuit break. It's not a national lockdown. Does it sound more appealing?
I think there's a bit of a misnomer here. Circuit breaking, well, that's the intent. But does it have the effect of breaking circuits? That's the test I would put on so-called circuit breaking tactics. I mean, we have not yet discovered anything I'm aware of as something that does effectively stop a local outbreak. If you look at the Leicester lockdown, for example, the first one to be given a so-called circuit breaker, then you saw infections flare up, then they went down again. But that's exactly what happens in parts of Sweden and in parts of Germany where there isn't massive local lockdown action taken. You can get flare-ups and then they can sometimes disappear as fast as they emerged. Now, I'm not saying that local lockdown has no effect. It probably has an accelerating effect. But just quite what that effect is, it's unclear. I mean, let's remember that national lockdown didn't stop the virus in Britain. It meant that the virus, perhaps you can argue, but the virus went down slightly faster than it went down in Sweden, which had no lockdown at all. But people were still getting coronavirus. There was no effective mechanism there. So this is, I think, the massive problem in the way that we talk about coronavirus. We never try to measure the efficacy of the remedies we put in place. Like, what will the rule of six, for example, do? What kind of effect do we genuinely believe this will have on the spread of the virus? And if so, what's the evidence for that? What evidence do we have to believe that a circuit breaker will break the circuit? And I don't know if the government is in possession of studies that show what effect it will have. But as I argue in my Telegraph column this morning, this is a huge problem right now. The government isn't open, it isn't transparent, it's not sharing its assumptions, it's not sharing its data. So as a result, there's not enough scrutiny, and that creates a lot more room for errors to creep in. I would be all in favour of these measures if I thought they would genuinely be circuit breakers. But I think we need to look back in the last few months and work out that we have been nowhere near as good at stifling the coronavirus as we thought we would be right at the beginning.
James, when we're looking at the measures that are being mooted, so much could happen as soon as next week, depending on what goes ahead. We're talking about a meeting that happened on Wednesday night. Who was in this meeting and what were the various things discussed?
Well, I don't think we know precisely who was in this meeting. I think this is one of the kind of issues of a kind of slight opacity here. This government talks a lot about data. There could be greater transparency about the data that would allow people to make, you know, understand more what the government is doing. I think we know that Boris Johnson was in this meeting. We know Chris Whitty, the chief medical officer, was in this meeting. I think one of the subtexts to this question is Chris Whitty is now pushing quite hard for greater restrictions. Some people might think this is playing the man, not the ball. But I do think it is interesting that there was this week under FOI came out an email from Patrick Vallance saying that he had back in March proposed an earlier lockdown and been chastised by, among others, Chris Whitty for the suggestion. Now, given that the view in government is that an earlier lockdown would have saved lives, this was quite an interesting email. And I wonder whether that is having some influence on Chris Whitty's thinking now. And I think this is the question, right, which is, there is a debate right now, which is, if you want to put it one way, you could say the government are learning from their mistakes last time round, and they are moving to try and stop the spread of the virus before it gets out of control. If you wanted to be unkind, you would say that they are fighting the last war, but they are looking back, and like French generals building the Maginot Line in the 1930s, you know, they are preparing for something that is going to be different this time round than it was the first time. And I think this is something that we need much more debate about. You know, there is an interesting question about the Spanish data, which seems to suggest that cases are coming back down. When the Spanish government have done things, they've introduced a rule of 10, but they haven't gone for another lockdown. And so I think we get into kind of an interesting, I think we need more discussion. We need more clarity about the data that the government is seeing and what they think it is showing and what metrics they are using to make their decisions.
I'm trying to work out on what basis they would withhold this information, because if they're going to ask us to lock down further, and right now all around the country people are probably going to do extra shopping this weekend just in case we end up with the kind of panic we had last time around. So why would they then not level with the country and say, look, we want to persuade you that things are bad, Chris Whitty thinks they're terrible, and we believe that the rise in cases will, if not arrested, lead to a huge increase in hospital numbers. Why do they think that, given that this didn't happen in Sweden, where a big rise in cases was not followed by serious health? I'm sure there's an answer to that. But last time around, there was an emergency. We were about 5 or 6 days away, we thought, from Lombardy-style scenes in the NHS. This time there isn't an emergency, and yet decisions are being made behind closed doors. I don't mind that, but I don't see what's so bad about sharing with the public some of the information which is leading them to make these decisions. And my concern is that without this scrutiny, mistakes might be made and we might end up with more lives lost as a result.
Now, James, one way in which you might start to see more scrutiny relates to Parliament's role in making decisions on coronavirus. A lot of this is done through emergency legislation, which means the government can just make these decisions. But that is renewed at the end of this month. So in theory, if there were enough MPs to say we are no longer comfortable with the government just making these sweeping decisions, they could try and break it down and could potentially lead to a situation where each measure has to be put to a debate and a vote. Do you think there's a chance of that happening?
I think this will all depend on Keir Starmer and what Labour do. I think there are undoubtedly people on the Tory benches who are, you know, you heard Desmond Swain's very angry point of order about how the rule of six had not been announced to Parliament, instead had been announced in a televised press conference. There hadn't been a debate, let alone a vote on it. And so there will undoubtedly be Tories who would push for that. The question is, what does Keir Starmer and the other opposition parties do? Do they say there should be more parliamentary scrutiny, or do they say that they back these emergency powers because of the virus? I think there is a problem for dealing with this without Parliament. Leave aside the kind of the democratic issues. I think it means that government doesn't feel the need to kind of bottom some things out before it happens. I think sometimes the process of having to come to Parliament, for example, to take one particular example, the grouse shooting exemption, right? That was something that would have been ironed out earlier, and that someone would have said, well, we're bound to get asked about this. So what activities above the rule of six are allowed? You know, is it all sports? Is it this sport, that kind of thing? I also think the government doesn't help its case when it only publishes the new law, which is going to come into force 15 minutes beforehand. I mean, that I think is slightly absurd and ridiculous, and does actually add to the case for some kind of level of parliamentary scrutiny. I wonder whether there is some compromise where the government can act but then has to seek approval. I think the government, again, also hasn't helped itself because, for example, on this rule of six, right, there is no reason why they could not have found time for a Commons debate on it, or a take note motion, which would not be binding but would have allowed the government to kind of indicate where opinion was on it.
Or at least answer questions. There are so many questions people have right now. And I'm not saying that, you know, Steve Baker in the House of Commons is going to spot something that the government's missed, but simply the act of going to Parliament and taking questions for an hour and a half, is a good way of trying to explain, because we're in a very difficult and quite a unique situation. This morning I had breakfast with a bunch of diplomats from the Nordic and Baltic countries. It's funny just to remind yourself just how Britain looks from foreign eyes. We're going through Brexit right now, but at the same time we're preparing for a second lockdown in a way that even the countries worst affected by the recent increase in COVID, Spain and France, are not. And to a lot of people, it just seems as if the British government is kind of has just lost the plot and is in a blind panic. And I would love to be able to have said to those ambassadors, don't worry, there is a plan, there is a strategy behind it, this is what it is. But it's simply the case right now that not even the cabinet know what Boris Johnson's COVID strategy is. And that's because I don't think he's got one. I think we have Chris Whitty, who's very worried, and coming up with a whole bunch of papers which may or may not contain errors that he hadn't spotted in the same way that the COVID death numbers turned out to do.
Fraser, just on that, we hear a lot about the Swedish strategy. Tory MPs are very keen to bring that up when they're airing grievances with the government strategy. But what about the other Nordic countries? What's the strategy there? Because we've heard previously about, you know, a backlash towards how Sweden were doing it.
Well, Denmark, for example, had far fewer deaths than Sweden, and now they're in the pretty same good place with COVID. Most of Scandinavia is. Sweden's doing a little bit better, but it's doing so having taken a far bigger death toll. The other Scandinavian countries will say, well, look, you might be better now, but look at the price you paid to get to this. We decided not to pay that price. The Swedes counter with a very interesting point. They were saying that Sweden was simply hit earlier and harder. If you look at the graph of infections, not the graph of deaths, to find the graph of fatal infections, you basically take the graph of deaths and rewind for about 20 days. So that shows that infections had peaked and were on the way down in much of Europe by the long before 23rd of March, which is when we decided to lock down here in Britain. So it might well be the case that Sweden's higher death rate wasn't high because it didn't lock down. It was high because right at the start, it got hit far harder at a time where neither Sweden nor the rest of Europe worked out just what was going on. Now, this is a hypothesis. There are lots of hypotheses, and the Swedes are great ones for saying, well, wait 6 months, wait a year, and then judge us after that, because the picture still hasn't been done yet. And a big part of the picture being filled in was, what good did lockdown do? Let's compare Sweden to its Nordic neighbours. Let's look at their starting points, because their starting points were very different. And then let's see how much the solutions helped the problems. And of course, Katie, I'm glad you did talk about that, because Andrew Neil is going to interview Anders Tegnell, who is the chief of Sweden's COVID strategy, chief epidemiologist. We tried to interview him on a train last night for Spectator TV, but even with the wonders of Swedish 4G, that didn't work out very well. He's agreed to speak to us later on this afternoon. So from about 5 o'clock tonight, we hope to have something on our Spectator TV channel, Andrew Neil, asking Anders Tegnell all about Sweden's experience and about lessons learned.
Thank you, Fraser. Thank you, James. And thank you for listening.
Get 12 weeks of The Spectator in print and online for just £12, and you'll also receive a complimentary 6 months of digital access to The Telegraph for free.